I have to admit, I don't normally go to a podium after Ron Wyden is the last to touch the microphone, and I am on my tippy toes, but we can get this working just fine, I think. Well, our purpose in our tent, Steve's intent and I, for putting together the second panel was to provide what we loosely called an outsider's perspective on the state of the Senate, and probably none of us, and certainly my three colleagues on the table, are not true outsiders to the Senate. And no introduction will do them and their careers justice. So just very quickly then, I'm joined here by my colleague Tom Mann, Averill Harriman Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies, and a longtime observer and observer participant in the world of Capitol Hill, so we won't really call him an outsider. Also, Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute, also both a longtime writer and observer of Congress and the Senate, both with Tom in the Broken Branch and many other publications. And Steve Smith, a former senior fellow here at Brookings and now Kate Gregg, Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences and Political Science at Washington University and the director of the Wiedenbaum Center at Washington University, and also my co-author in a book about the filibuster, as well as many other books, particularly about the Senate. So we're each going to take about 5 minutes to offer some perspective on the Senate, perhaps some reaction to this morning. We'll start with Steve, then me, and then Norm, and then Tom.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. I'm going to start, and we are going to try to stick with the five-minute rule, so we're obviously operating in the House of Representatives. So I got to talk fast. And Norm asked me whether I was going to Tom asked me whether I was going to let it rip. Okay, I'll let it rip. You know, we had three very sophisticated observers of the Senate, and I think we saw about the strongest defense of the filibuster that we can see, and I think it's very weak. 30 seconds? Is that all right? No, look, the nature of representation in American politics has changed fundamentally. How senators relate to their constituents and to each other has changed fundamentally over the last generation. We have very polarized parties. It's been that way really for 25 or 30 years. It's not a short-term thing. We have a huge mandatory legislative and nomination agenda that's growing. It's been growing over the last generation, and it continues to grow. This mandatory agenda has meant that there has been a higher and higher premium put on time. And it's made it easier and easier to do damage by even delaying action in the Senate, doing damage to the legislative agenda, doing damage to the executive branch, and doing damage to how we govern ourselves. So what I want to argue is that step by step, the Senate really has changed even more fundamentally in the most recent Congresses. In fact, I think that the Senate has become a qualitatively different institution in the last few Congresses, as both minorities and majorities have fully exploited their procedural options. Let me just highlight a few things with the help of the figures that you have in your hands. In recent Congresses, most of us know this, both Democratic with both Democratic and Republican minorities, very few major measures are untouched by minority efforts to delay or prevent action. You can see that in Figure 1, which, of course, represents cloture motions. That's not a direct measure of efforts to delay or obstruct. But you can see in the second figure that there has been a substantial increase in the number of measures that have been modified, blocked, or long delayed, with direct evidence of obstruction with respect to key vote measures. CQ identifies measures subject to key votes, a couple of dozen in each Congress. And in the recent Congresses, virtually every measure taken up by the Senate is affected. We've also seen more silence from the minority, both Democratic and Republican minorities, to requests for clearance from the majority. We've seen more frequent objections to majority party unanimous consent requests to structure debate and the amending process. You can see that in Figure 3. We've seen holds extended to more minor measures and nominations. That's not easy for an outsider to document, but surely it's true. We've seen more delays by minority senators in getting themselves to the floor to offer amendments, forcing some live quorums here in the recent past, and even an increase in the number of minority party unanimous consent requests on their part to try to change up the agenda outlined by the majority. Now, the minority's moves have motivated majority party leaders to leave nothing to chance. They just have to close things down. Beyond having a quick trigger in filing for cloture, which they certainly have had, majority leaders and bill managers of both parties have done a number of things. For example, we've all seen that they more frequently filled the amendment tree. They've more frequently put a placeholding amendment in place so that there's a pending amendment blocking the minority the opportunity to freely offer amendments until some agreement or cloture has been invoked. They've tightened unanimous consent agreements because they had to make them even more airtight than they have in the past, including the use of 60-vote requirements for the adoption of amendments. They moved to many non-conference mechanisms to avoid debatable conference motions with far greater frequency. And on some of the most sensitive matters, like appropriations bills, they've avoided floor action altogether, at least on initial consideration, by facilitating the creation of omnibus bills in conference. Now, for years, my metaphor for this process has been kind of a procedural arms race, a tit for tat. You move, then I'm going to tighten up, and then I'm going to move. But honestly, that metaphor just seems kind of inadequate to what we're seeing now. I think we need a more medical term, something like a syndrome, an obstruct and restrict syndrome, in which the minority party obstructs or delays at every opportunity, not trusting the majority at any step in the process, and the majority merely assumes the worst of the minority and starts closing down the process before there's the slightest sign of overt obstructionism. So at least since the nuclear option episode in the spring of 2005, the Senate has been bogged down in this obstruct and restrict syndrome, an ORS, if you want to go to your local medical facility. So under ORS, each party assumes, until shown otherwise, that the other party will fully exploit its procedural options. The assumption of universal delay or obstruction by the minority appears to have prompted, perhaps in response to these intensifying partisan pressures and real time constraints, nearly automatic restrictive moves by the majority. And in fact, I think the majority leader will risk charges of political malpractice if he fails to structure floor consideration as much as possible. The minority, in return, hardly dares give an inch. So I think this is a materially different Senate, with consequences for the role of the institution and for senators. And that's a subject we can pursue further in discussion. Let me end just by providing a tentative answer to a somewhat different question. Does the party obstructing suffer politically? In August and January of this past year, August of 2009 and January, Jim Gibson, a colleague of mine at WashU, and I conducted a panel study of public opinion toward health care and the filibuster. The first table in the handout shows that attitudes about using the filibuster were very weakly correlated with partisanship and healthcare policy attitudes in August. Very little structure to those attitudes. They were in the direction you'd expect. Conservatives were somewhat more supportive of the filibuster practice than liberals, Republicans somewhat more than Democrats. But by January, just after the Senate completed action on its bill on December 24th, opinion was far more strongly sorted by partisanship and policy attitude. Not shown in the figure is that this sorting was much, much more complete among the politically sophisticated voters than for others. The more you were attentive to politics, the more you tended to side with your party and your side on the health care issue with respect to the use of the filibuster. The second table shows that attitudes about the filibuster have no net effect on vote intention, that is, where the respondent expects to vote in the fall, independent of their partisanship and their policy attitude. So in today's public, it appears that there is really no constituency for filibuster reform other than what you would predict based on their party, their short-term partisan and policy advantages. Jim and I will be later this year quizzing a national sample in far greater detail about cloture reform options and some of the determinants of that support and opposition. But right now it looks like if you want a filibuster, you pay no price with your home constituency.
Great. Thank you, Steve. I thought I would make just three brief arguments about the history of the filibuster and then offer a few thoughts on the future for reform. And I think it's always important to revisit the history here because it's often used as a defense for not changing anything about the Senate and about Rule 22. But I think if we think through some of the lessons from early Senate history, we might come at that same question differently. So first of three arguments. First, the filibuster was not an original part of the Senate. If anything, it was a mistake. We have many received wisdoms about the filibuster, and most of them turn out not to be true. The most persistent myth is probably about the Founding Fathers' constitutional vision for the Senate. That is, says that the filibuster and extended debate and deliberation were part of the framers' view, and cherishing of minority rights was part of the vision, the framers' intention of the Senate. Once we dig into early history of Congress, it seems the filibuster actually was probably accidental. House and Senate rule books in 1789 looked an awful lot alike. They both had, as Dick Baker mentioned this morning, a previous question motion. The House kept theirs, later turned it into a device for letting majorities rule. The Senate no longer has that rule. What happened to the Senate's previous question motion? It's 1805. Vice President Aaron Burr is presiding over the Senate. He has freshly been indicted for the murder of Alexander Hamilton, and he offers this advice to the Senate, and that doesn't stop the Senate from taking his advice. He says, you are a great deliberative body, but if you were a truly great Senate, you would have a cleaner rule book, and yours is a mess. And he has points out there are lots of rules that do the same thing. And he singles out that previous question motion. Now, as I said, today we know the House uses that motion today to cut off debate by majority vote. But in 1805, when Burr is looking at the rules, neither chamber used the rule that way. Majorities were still sort of experimenting with it. And so when Aaron Burr said, get rid of that rule, they didn't think twice. The next year they cleaned their rule book, they dropped the motion from the Senate rule book. Why? Not because senators in 1806 sought to protect minority rights and extended debate. They got rid of the rule, as best we can tell, because Aaron Burr told them to. Once that rule was gone, senators still did not filibuster. But deletion of that rule made possible future filibusters because they no longer had the rule to turn to later when filibusters emerged in the 1830s. So first, it doesn't strike me that filibuster is an original part of the Senate. Second, it seems that the golden age of the Senate was not so golden. Now, when I tell the Aaron Burr story, a typical response is, well, fine, the filibuster and extended debate may not be original to the Senate. But surely we say that it later becomes a cherished part of the Senate, right, which is why we call the Senate's past the golden age of the Senate. But I think that view also misreads Senate history, right? We typically glorify the 19th century Senate as the golden age of the Senate. We say filibusters reserved for the great issues of the day and that all senators cherished extended debate. But it was not universally seen as a golden age. When filibusters did occur, leaders tried to ban them. Senate leaders tried repeatedly, late 19th century, early 20th century, to reinstate that previous question motion. But more often than not, senators gave up their quest for reform when they saw that opponents would kill it by filibuster, thus putting the majority's other priorities at risk. Of course, unable to reform Senate rules, leaders developed other innovations, such as unanimous consent agreements. These seem to have been the fallback option for managing a chamber that was prone to filibuster. Of course, as we've referred to already today, it took a world war and a president's commitment to reforming the Senate in 1917 to shame the Senate into adopting Rule 22, its first cloture rule. And, of course, the Senate compromised at a two-thirds rule not because it loved supermajority rules, but because a minority likely blocked more serious reform. So first, it doesn't seem filibusters are integral to the history, the origins of the Senate. It doesn't seem that the Senate's golden age necessarily was as golden as we think of it. And third, keep in mind that reform today is complicated by senators' situational ethics. That is, where you stand depends on where you sit. As Marty Peon put it perfectly this morning, I can build a bridge or I can blow up the bridge depending on my party's status. 1993, when Clinton was first elected and Democrats-controlled Congress, a little lobbying shop opened up on K Street called Action Not Gridlock. It was a group that had been formed to lobby for filibuster reform. Doing some work on filibuster politics in 94, I would periodically clip a story. That was when you used to clip them, about the group. But And I followed it for that year in 1995 when Republicans took control of the Senate and Republicans started complaining about the Senate being tied in knots by the Democrats. I went looking. Where is Action Not Gridlock? It was gone. They had folded up shop on K Street. Now the majorities weren't in the majority. Democrats weren't in the majority. Hands off the filibuster. Of course, when we hear calls for reform like we do today, we have to keep in mind the situational ethics for senators of Senate reform. Senators like to cloak procedural positions in high-minded principle, but it is almost always about politics. Not always, but almost always about politics. There are very few procedural purists in the Senate. So, given entrenched myth about the Senate, about the filibuster, and given that opponents of reform nearly always have the upper hand, how is reform likely to happen, if at all? Here are just very brief thoughts, and we can come back to, I'm sure many have thoughts about potential reform efforts here. First, I suspect we'll continue to see more statutory debate restrictions, that is, bans written into the laws that ban filibusters, for instance, like the budget reconciliation that became headline news earlier this year. We see them in the health care bill. We see them slowly being written into the financial services reform, right? Episodes where the Senate decides that ensuring the Senate can act to ban a filibuster is important on a particular policy issue that my guess is we'll continue to see these written into the laws. My guess we'll see efforts, most likely unsuccessful, to use the constitutional option that is at the beginning of the new Congress trying to guarantee the majority and essentially an up or down vote on a set of rules changes. I suspect we'll also hear a renewed call for the Senate to adopt restrictions on Rule 22, but perhaps to put them, these restrictions, into a place several years in the future when current senators don't know whether they'll be in the majority or the minority. This is a proposal, I think, most recently by Jeff Merkley from Oregon. Even that veil of ignorance about the future, though, might not be enough to convince senators to give up on some of their procedural rights. But I'd encourage our subsequent thoughts about those potential avenues of reform. I'll just end up my 5 minutes with one of my favorite quotes by a Senate leader. When asked, should the Senate move by majority rule? He said, quote, that rule would everywhere be hailed as one of the greatest improvements of the age. Henry Clay, 1841.
I'm delighted to be here, first of all. I sat through the last panel with wonderment. I kept looking at Steve's four charts, and I thought that when Marty Payon very perceptively talked about the Stockholm syndrome, that perhaps at this point we needed a little refinement. I now call it the Athens syndrome. It's people sitting in Athens as the country collapses and the riots occur saying, this is the birthplace of democracy. It's perfect. But times change and things do change. Now, I do happen to agree with Marty Payoni that the problem at this point is more the culture than it is the rules. We have a culture, a political culture, that has degraded in a couple of ways. Most important is that we're now seeing a culture of obstruction for obstruction's sake, combined with what's become almost a parliamentary culture. The Senate is not a body of individuals so much anymore. It is a body of disciplined parties, where party unity is achieved far more frequently. We are not a parliamentary system. And a political system set up around flexibility with a separation of powers, with different institutions having different ways of operating, knowing that you can have a party that may control all the levers of power, or you might have a real division, can operate with delays, with issues to overcome under all of those circumstances. But it becomes much, much more difficult if you have parties operating, especially in the Senate, with a level of discipline. Now, the issue of obstruction for obstruction's sake goes beyond the four charts that Steve has there. If we think of the filibuster as a process used by an intense minority to protect the rights of that minority over an issue of great national significance, how can you justify bills and nominations that pass unanimously or near unanimously going through two waves of filibusters? And in the last Congress, for example, we had a bill that was designed to extend unemployment benefits that went through two filibusters with long delays. It took 7 full days of debate that passed unanimously. We had another bill on credit card reform that went through 6 days of debate not with great discussion about the substance or nuance of the bill, not with discussion about amendments to try to perfect it, that passed nearly unanimously. And we had a nomination for a federal judge reported out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously that sat for 124 days after being reported out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously, went through a filibuster on the Senate floor, took 6 days, and passed with one dissenting vote. That is not what Bob Dove, I think, meant when he talked about minority rights so much. I don't want to put words into his mouth, but it is certainly a degradation of a culture, and it is the use of a set of techniques only to take up more floor time to keep other things from happening, to obstruct for obstruction's sake. Now, if you have a problem that is more the culture than the rules, because those same rules existed 30 years ago, those same rules did not work in the same fashion back when the culture was different, you do have to focus on the culture, but it doesn't mean you leave the rules in place necessarily as they are. Ira Shapiro, a longtime veteran of the Senate whom I met 35 years ago when we worked there together, is now working on another book on the Senate that looks back at the 1970s in particular and how the Senate operated then. And he noted to me in our conversations a comment that Justice Jackson made that the Constitution is not a suicide pact, and said the Senate rules are not a suicide pact either. So modest adjustment in the rules, which doesn't mean that you eliminate powers of the minority or necessarily eliminate the filibuster. I'm perfectly content to keep a filibuster rule in place, and I think that there are reasons to worry about the Senate becoming a junior version of the House. But when you see the two bites of the apple, a filibuster on the motion to proceed, and if what you have is a body where you want to make or preserve the right of a minority that feels intensely about an important issue, being able to stop, deliberate, and have its intense views heard, why should there be filibusters on the motion to proceed followed by filibusters on the bill itself? The 100 hours of debate that went to 30 hours of debate, where the 30 hours now are used only to drag out a debate, at minimum, moving that to 30 hours divided between the majority and the minority, could streamline a process while preserving the ability of a minority to have its views known. Finding a way to make sure that you could, if the majority leader decides that he wants to draw the line and bring the place to a halt, and go round the clock, that the onus is not on the majority to be there and just leave one or two minority members who have the role of sticking around to keep noting the absence of a quorum, where you no longer have what we did have when civil rights bills were filibustered, which at least was some debate, so you could get a national debate on this issue where the minority could make its case. That just doesn't apply anymore. Finding a way to put the onus on the minority to be there if you're going around the clock, whether it's by the rather novel notion of Senator Frank Lautenberg that if the minority isn't present, you can move very quickly to a vote, or simply requiring that a majority or a supermajority of those who are opposed to cloture have to be there for a certain number of quorum calls over a period of time, or you can move to an expedited vote, would help in this sense as well. And what I would also consider, because I believe that the hold, which may have its purposes, has become degraded even more. We are now seeing nominations held up not because a senator or a staffer says, oh, gee, this might affect my state, but by clusters of nominations held up when there is no objection to the nominee whatsoever as hostage-taking mechanisms, and often held to the point of torture or death. This does enormous damage to the fabric of governance. We have important agencies going leaderless for months or years at a time. We have people who make the sacrifice to go into public service who are left twisting in the winds, unable to move from their current jobs, unable to figure out a way to move their families to coincide with a school year, all at the whim of individuals that had nothing to do with the advice and consent process. Finding a way, understanding that the hold is simply a notice that you will deny unanimous consent, and understanding that 100 senators have been culpable in this process. You can, if leaders didn't back up their senators by denying unanimous consent when they're not on the floor, this wouldn't work as well. But understanding as well that the facile notion that the leader, all the majority leader has to do is bring something up, when even on a nomination that doesn't have a filibuster on the motion to proceed, you're going to take days out of the Senate schedule for an individual nominee. And we have 100 nominees being held now, most of them for no reason related to their own nominations, many of them for 6 months to a year or more. We have to find a way around that. My solution would be that, which is in some ways a variation of what Ron Wyden has suggested, that if you want a genuine filibuster, bring the place to a halt, go round the clock, get 35 public Senate signatures on a petition saying that you'll do that, then stop the place and go round the clock. But if you can't get 35 public signatures, then hold such as the ones that Richard Shelby brought, 70 nominations held up so that he could get something for Alabama, I think would be much, much harder to get those 35 signatures and then have a time limit before you force action on a nomination or a bill. There are ways where you can adjust the rules to fit the destructive culture of our time, and I'm all for those changes.
I've been listening to the conference with great interest, and I've gradually detected the architecture, the structure of this conference that Sarah and Steve had in mind, and I think it was done masterfully. I mean, we began with Ron Wyden, and God love him. You can't want to find a more serious, substantively serious senator who has invested years on one-on-one meetings with his colleagues on both sides of the aisle to try to frame some broad approach to big problems like health policy and tax reform and other things. He's so frustrated by the scoring of political points and the absence of serious legislating, and believes that principal negotiations across party lines can take place and produce better legislation, and gave, you know, some examples. One is the new tax reform bill that he and Judd Gregg put together. Judd Gregg is leaving the Senate at the end of the year. Godspeed to that effort. The other was, of course, Wyden-Bennett, where he actually put together a substantial number of co-sponsors on both sides of the aisle, but was absolutely undercut at the beginning by the minority party strategy not to engage on health care. And so neither Bob Bennett nor Judd Gregg nor Lamar Alexander nor any other Republican senator was willing to speak up to defend that bill or any other bill of that would lay the predicate for building broader agreement and having bipartisan support on the Hill. And Ron's sort of short-term solution is to deal with secret holes. Seems to me most of the people putting holes on are pretty proud of them, and Tom Coburn is certainly happy to have them public. Probably is patrolling at the margins, doesn't get to the heart of the matter. But at least we have the sort of problems laid out and a reinforcement of what we're up against. Then we had a panel of three people who know the Senate as an institution, and for those of us who are congressional scholars and students and teachers, we heard some of our lectures in comments that they made. The Senate is a remarkable, marvelous, flexible, uniquely powerful
upper chamber. It really is unusual, and that is to say an institution for all seasons. That's how many of us felt for a long period of time. But we've been mugged by reality, and I think reflected on this third panel, from what I hear, is a sense among many people that the traditional Senate, with its rules and procedures, doesn't fit with the contemporary party system and the political environment in which the Congress operates today, that the very things we used to applaud the Senate for, of producing these agreements across party lines, of the co-sponsorships. Oh, Hillary loved joining with Tom Coburn and doing this little bit and that little bit. But the reality is the old idea that if you had a supermajority requirement, you'd force negotiations to the center, produce more deliberative, moderate, wise legislation, just isn't upheld by the reality of the experience in this time. And what we're seeing is, in fact, growing discontent, even among those powerful senators who are advantaged, presumably, by this system, because some of them are actually serious about tending to the country's problems and see the very frustrations. We could go down the appropriations process. It isn't just the House that succumbed. It's the Senate as well. We don't appropriate like we used to. We don't authorize like we did before, and we certainly don't confirm nominations in a way that staffs the government. Okay, we got a problem. What do we do? Abolish the Senate. Now, there's a thought. We could have a unicameral, but it's really hard to do under this constitutional system. Second, we could change the party system, and in the end, that's probably the only way we're going to deal with this, but there's no simple way of doing it. Probably requires first creating less partisan parity, one sort of dominant party forcing the other to change, pulling members of the minority into negotiations because they're bored with just sitting there opposing and losing, but it's going to take a while to that. We can try with specifics to discredit the filibuster and the hold, and that works sometimes, depending on the structure of public opinion. We can use some of the existing alternatives within the Senate rules and law that allow one to deal with delay tactics and filibusters. Obviously, budget reconciliation is one of the most important, and the Senate Democrats saw their opportunity this time and took advantage of it in the end stage of health reform. And it was a good thing that alternative existed in the rules. Framers didn't anticipate the filibuster, the normal two-thirds majority. They didn't anticipate a budget act and the reconciliation process. But things have a way of working out. Now, one way is alternative then, and I sort of end with this, is to change the rules. And there are various ways you can change the rules while still maintaining the possibility of the Senate being fundamentally different than the House. And Norm is getting into this. Carve out exceptions to unlimited debate. Extend reconciliation to the appropriations process. Set up a fast track for executive and judicial nominations. Then you can begin to limit the time-consuming requirements associated with cloture further than you have already, giving the majority leader the power to bring not just on the executive calendar and the complications associated with that, but legislation to the floor, non-debatable motions by the majority leader to move to proceed with a piece of legislation, quicker ripening of the cloture motion. The bottom line is that I think it's important for any institution to take a look at itself in its changed circumstances and environment and ask if this is really the best of all possible legislative bodies. Yes, we should beware of unintended consequences, but hey, the intended consequences are pretty bad, too, and maybe we ought to do something about it.
Excellent. Thank you. I think I'll open up with a few questions to the panel, and then we'll take it from there. There's been a sentiment, at least this morning, from the first panel, that perhaps the solution is that leaders should use the rules they already have. So I thought maybe we'd spend a little bit of time thinking about this tough guy solution. Can it work? Why and when would it work? Or what are the limitations of the tough guy solution?
Well, one thing that I would do, and this also gets at what Marty said, if I could do one thing, it would be to have the Senate in session from 9 a.m. Monday to 5 p.m. Friday, 5 days a week, 3 weeks out of every month. Now, if I could combine that with no fundraising during those 15 days, so you've got half the time when you can fundraise, so that people aren't rushing off the campus to go make their call time work, and with a generous housing allowance so that you could move people more ably to get their families to Washington, you might be able to create a different collegiality that is that resembles something close to what we did see in the earlier days in the Senate. But other than that, it just isn't clear to me that if, for example, getting back to what I was saying about nominations, the leaders can ignore holds, but they do so at their own peril. And there is, even if you're around 5 days a week, a limited amount of time that you could spend on the floor. And if you have a party, not just an individual or two or three, but a whole party determined to drag things out simply so that they can keep things from happening, I don't know that there's much that a leader can do that isn't going to create more problems than it solves.
Well, I agree with that. And, just imagine, I mean, holds are a relatively minor problem in a larger setting in which delay and ultimately obstruction have become the norm. And I should say, under both parties sitting in the minority. It has become materially more severe, I think, since the Democrats regained a majority. But in fact, many of these trends were in place, and many of these minority inventions were Democratic inventions. So on the question of nominations or holds more generally, even with respect to legislation, we've hit the nail on the head. The trouble is, for the minority leader to bring up a hold, to bring up a nomination on a matter, on a nomination of just modest significance that might end up taking 2 or 3 days of the Senate time just to get to the floor, let alone through the floor, is too big a price to pay when you have health care reform, climate change, stimulus bills, and the other legislation to take care of. And it's not too surprising that a minority recognizes how precious that floor time is and that it will eventually be exhausted. So slowing things down at every stage limits the amount of time you can give to that larger agenda. And the irony here is that there's a real political price, and the price tends to be paid by the majority party. It's in charge, after all, the public says. Why can't you get on to the most important items? Why didn't you follow through on your promises to take up this issue and take up that issue? The minority knows that calculation perfectly well, and they're pretty good at figuring out just how far they can push the Senate without taking some of the blame themselves. What happens, at least on the most serious issues, is that the public sorts itself out pretty much as partisans and as policy advocates, depending upon who's advantaged. And my guess is that we're basically in a period where the public opinion about the filibuster crystallizes and then fades, then crystallizes and fades, and then maybe crystallizes in the opposite direction, then fades again. So there's not much public demand for this. So the answer to the question is that the majority leader is in a very difficult spot. They're now doing pretty much everything they can do to try to squeeze down unlimited debate. And the irony of this is that it's made the Senate a far more formal institution. They're almost always now living under a rule seeking permission seeking unanimous consent to set aside the pending amendment so they can even take up their own amendment, then finding themselves boxed in when cloture is about to invoke, then being forced to agree to a 60-vote requirement on their amendment because it's the only way they can even get a vote on their amendment. Is this the Senate that we heard advocated in the first panel? I don't think so. But it's the Senate we have, and it's the likely the Senate we're going to keep unless we actually address the rules.
I thought we'd take a couple more minutes to think about holds and potential reforms and how they might be enforceable. First, and some of this has been touched on, Ron Wyden referred to public ownership of holds. Is that likely to make a difference? Would that solve a problem? How might any restrictions on holds be enforced? Can we think about unintended consequences? Are there ways forward here on holds, even if we think it's the smaller of the problems that the Senate faces?
I'm deeply skeptical of reform that deals with holds and not with the underlying arrangements that make possible. I mean, holds are the a signal of an intention not to agree to a unanimous consent agreement, right? And not exactly built into the rules. It's just it's a reality. And so I think much more encouraging is to set up various fast-track procedures for certain kinds of legislative matters that would limit the time for consideration and therefore, by its very fact, limit the damage that holds can do. I think that's much more efficacious than this one case where I think transparency doesn't really help. I'm big on transparency, but for the most part, the senators who, in using holds, take great pride in that, and oftentimes, as we saw, with Senator Shelby, it's for a purpose back home. You can embarrass them occasionally, but I think better to go to the underlying structure of the rules.
Well, I would take a little bit of issue with that. I mean, first, I do think there's a real distinction between holds on nominations and holds on bills. I don't have any problem, by and large, with holds on bills. If it's something of significance, then the leader can move on it, and that's fine. But when you have 1,141 executive nominations that require Senate confirmation, which itself is appalling, frankly, one thing we ought to do is cut that number. We ought to cut it in half, frankly. But when you've got that number and you have 500 of those that are significant policy positions, then I think some action is necessary. And frankly, I think if I could, I would move to privilege motions and expedited process on the nominations. But I also think that there, real transparency in many cases could make a difference. You have some of these nominees, people that we know, who have been held up for months and have no idea who's doing it. And in many cases, if you make it public, you know, we had the famous example in the past where we had hundreds and hundreds of Air Force nominations held for months, and we had no idea who was doing it or why until we finally found out that Larry Craig was objecting to the Air National Guard pulling a couple of planes out of Idaho, and so he was simply blocking the Air Force. If we'd known that from the beginning, the public pressure that eventually, once it became public, caused him to abandon that route would have worked. Shelby dropped most of those nominations when it became public that he was holding up important people. Many of these nominations that are of great significance would, I think, move more quickly if we had a sense of who was doing it. So it would make a difference if you could make, at the margins, but significantly if you could make them public, but it's not enough.
Let me just add a word to that. You know, the history holds, as we heard, date back many years. Senator Wyden certainly was right that senatorial courtesy was certainly a big part of it. But in the 1970s, when the Senate agenda began to expand, Senator Byrd, first under Senator Mansfield's leadership and then on his own, recognized that he needed a more regular clearance process. His agenda was just getting too large. And this clearance process had the effect of turning the privilege of placing a hold into more of a right, because the floor leadership now would, on a regular basis, ask you whether it was okay to proceed on these legislative or executive calendar items. And beginning with Senator Baker as majority leader in the early 80s, every leader, until this decade, every leader said, I'm no longer going to observe holds. You're going to have to come to the floor and object. And every leader failed to follow through for just the reasons these guys have mentioned. You need this kind of clearance. You cannot afford to have surprises on the floor. You cannot mess up your schedule on a Wednesday or a Thursday when everyone's in a rush because of an unanticipated objection to a UC request to bring up a matter. So that's where the teeth come. And as Tom says, the real problem here is you can't even get it up if you have that objection to a UC request. Then that would, of course, the option is to file for cloture and then invoke that very cumbersome process and a very time-consuming one on a very relatively a nomination of modest importance. Most majority leaders cannot do that. The teeth in this comes from the fact that the modern Senate has a huge agenda, much, much larger than the Senate of the past. That's its most fundamental weakness. Every majority leader is working with the clock, and it provides teeth to delay and obstruction that we haven't seen in previous generations.
Before I open it up, just one more question, at the risk of opening myself up to good jokes. But assuming we could agree on some limited set of reforms, either to Rule 22 or to unanimous consent and so forth, maybe you could sketch for me the most realistic path to reform you could see occurring. Right. Is there some path to reform that is viable, apart from our sort of outsider scholarly perspectives on how this might happen?
Well, go ahead. My thought is that a direct attack on Rule 22 is not likely. As it is obvious, individual senators gain a lot of clout in our system by virtue of the protection that the minority right gives them. And so there are Democratic senators, even junior Democratic senators in the current Senate, who have expressed concern about going too far in the area of reform. So it seems to me that the likely route is for the Democratic leadership to have a more modest package of reforms. And Tom and Norm ticked off many of the things that probably would be included. Limiting debate on some motions, like the motion to proceed, maybe on the motion to go to conference, trying to focus filibusters as much as possible on bills and amendments, maybe even limiting debate to some degree on amendments. I'd certainly favor that. I think going the statutory route that both that the others mentioned, and especially on appropriations bills, we talk about the power of the Senate, but Congress has lost an awful lot of power to the executive branch for its inability to come to grips with serious floor debate on appropriations bills. And about every other year, it happens to be an election year, they pass up almost all floor debate on appropriations bills in this last decade, and that's a shame. You could probably change that. The next time there's a reconciliation bill going through, you could probably change the Budget Act by statute. And interestingly enough, a reconciliation bill would be protected from a filibuster. So I think, as Sarah suggested, that the majority might look for ways to find statutory solutions in limited areas as the Senate has pursued them very proactively. In the health care bill, the new Medicare Commission will have the right, basically the fast-track right, to bring proposals making savings in Medicare to the Senate, and how much more important a piece of legislation could you expect to have in the next decade? And yet it's going to be considered under debate limits. The Senate just accepted that. When a Republican senator asked in December whether this makes the health care bill subject then to the two-thirds majority, the parliamentarian correctly advised the chair that no, this is a rule that's not changing the standing rules of the Senate. It's going to be statutory language, even though it has the effect of a rule. And so the bill as a whole is subject only to the 60-vote limit. I think for that reason, Democrats might be looking more in that direction. And I agree, too, that there seems to be, I bet, some bipartisan consensus that on executive calendar items, given how much stake the Republicans put in 2005 on the advice and consent clause obligations of the Senate, to doing something to limiting debate along those lines. So I think some package like that would be essential for the Democrats to agree to. If they could do that before January and then use a ruling of the chair to bring this package to the floor and to a vote, that seems to me to be the most likely avenue that we're going to see.
I think there's a slim possibility that we could get a kind of replay of 1975, where you do have the vice president at the beginning of the session say the Senate is not a continuing body, and that doesn't mean that they jam a rules package through, but rather that they then engage in negotiation to get a modest package. The odds remain very slim of that, but I think it's at least has to be out there. Otherwise, there is some promise in a number of junior senators, including Republicans, who think that a lot of what has been happening is foolish, that it is not a good way to operate. And I think you're going to find even some people who would be surprising otherwise, who would say, I want to stand on principle, but operating this way is not the way to operate. So there's a small chance that it would be a modest package, though, no doubt.
But I think there are serious efforts underway to try to find some agreement across party lines. Again, a minority of members on both sides, but then you begin to build, and then you put it into a leadership contest dynamic with Chuck Schumer, chairman of the Rules Committee, suddenly deciding being the champion of reform as a way to generate support among this huge younger cohort of Democratic senators. So I'd say the odds are a little higher of something happening this round than in recent years.
Great. Any questions?
Rick Beth from the Congressional Research Service. And I can think of a great many things that I'd like to say, but let me just limit myself to one, and that is perhaps directed particularly at Norm Ornstein, but someone really ought to explain how you're going to do a constitutional option if it requires the vice president ruling contrary to the precedent of the Senate on a constitutional point of order. Vice president is supposed to rule on constitutional points of order. It's supposed to be submitted to the Senate. That's why all those previous efforts ran into trouble, because once the point of order is submitted to the Senate, it's debatable and you're back into the cloture problem. And to make that ruling, the vice president would not only have to rule where a president says he shouldn't be ruling, but would have to be making a ruling that is contrary to established precedent and would therefore be establishing a precedent that the vice president can rule any way he wants to in disregard of precedent, both of which would upset some of the fundamental regulations under which the Senate runs and turn over Senate power to someone who's not a member of or accountable to the Senate. Now, if there's going to be a way of getting at rules changes through a constitutional option, it seems to me it has to explain how you can get around those genuinely nuclear possibilities of messing up the Senate's fundamental precedential structure in a way that would be very hard to put back. I don't only address that to Professor Ornstein, but if anybody else wants to comment on that.
I guess I would say a couple of things. The first is, in practical terms, it's dangerous to do this, obviously. Not quite as dangerous as the nuclear option that Majority Leader Frist was discussing, where you're challenging the rules right in midstream. But you're going to create a fracture and you're going to create a precedent that could result in much more substantial changes down the road as new majorities come in. But having said that, I think Tom Udall has made a rather strong case that there are a number of precedents of vice presidents in the past suggesting at the beginning of a new session that the Senate is not a continuing body. Now, it is true that when Nelson Rockefeller did this in early 1975, and it caused turmoil in the Senate, and they took a timeout and then reached a compromise on the changes that moved us from two-thirds to 60 senators, that in effect the Senate said, well, remember what Rockefeller said, never mind, after that. But it was there, and Rockefeller wasn't the first vice president who had toyed with the notion of the Senate not being a continuing body. The notion that it's built into the rules already that the Senate is a continuing body and that they have to be restricted by that, you know, what if the Senate passed a bill that said that every future Senate is constrained by the law that we're now passing? Therefore, if a future Senate changes it, it is unlawful. Well, of course, we know that that's simply not accurate. So that's a catch-22 built into the rules. I'm not advocating using that option because I think it has it would set its own precedents, but I don't think it's unprecedented.
Well, the only thing I could add to this is that it's, I think, at least in major part a political question. What are the constraints on the opposition to reform that are imposed by the public? And so it's an open question as to whether or not in today's political world the public is sufficiently upset with how government is working that a case can be made that obstructing a modest reform package is by going to nuclear option lengths would be tolerated on the other end. So there's a political limit. If, on the other hand, the public is indifferent to these rules changes, and that's its normal condition, then I agree that the majority is unlikely to push this very far, especially if there is some division within the majority party about how far to go. So I think, you know, there are several necessary conditions here that have to come in place. Generally, they're not in place, and so serious reform doesn't take place. But among those necessary conditions, I think, is some consensus among the majority party, and presumably that'll be the Democrats, but who knows, some public concern that the Senate isn't functioning well, and so some limit on how far the opposition is willing to take things in following all of these options that you detail, Rick.
Ira Shapiro. I think Norm and Tom were getting at something very important in their comments that suggests that the senators themselves, and an increasing number of them, are deeply frustrated and perhaps even embarrassed by the institution that they're being part of. And I've actually, you know, you can look at the list of Republican senators and see quite a large number of them who have been constructive public servants operating on a bipartisan basis in different times of their career. But now it's not working that way. So I think to some extent, you know, the rules change only comes when the senators take it upon themselves to say, we didn't come to Washington to exacerbate the differences in the country. We came to Washington to overcome them. And we didn't come to Washington to be part of a diminished and indeed debased institution. So I think the question is going to be whether senators are willing to take it upon themselves to make changes. One thought I had, which is pie in the sky, and I will admit it, but I did have it before the British election recently. Actually, it would be interesting to see two senators in the fall, a Republican and a Democrat, who said, we're going to run for leader together. I don't know who's going to be the majority leader or the minority leader, but the point is the Senate is supposed to work in a way that it hasn't been working before. Now, that's improbable and unlikely to happen, but the British coalition government was quite unlikely to happen as well. So that's more of a comment than a question.
I would just respond to your comment. Essentially, you've pegged precisely what happened in 1975 to make reform possible. Essentially, senators from both parties, to some degree, agreeing that the reasons they came to Washington are being frustrated, they can't actually get things done, and thus reducing the threshold to 60 serve their own individual personal agendas. Of course, that's done in a period with pretty wide ideological overlap between the parties. And the question is, even if you had a cohort of senators from either party thinking that way today, and clearly there are this sort of younger cohort of senators who do think that way, are the constraints imposed by their parties just sort of too much to allow that to happen.
Hi, Greg Warrow, Columbia University. I just kind of want to play devil's advocate here. I think that something should be done in terms of reform. But there are sort of two issues here. How do we measure dysfunctionality in the Senate? You talked about abolishing the Senate. There were calls to do this at the beginning of the 19th century, or I'm sorry, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, because there were one or two filibusters, very, very notable filibusters. And people back then were saying the Senate is dysfunctional. But we look at the way the Senate was working now compared to the way it was working then, and there's no comparison, really. And so I guess my question is, how do we get to a point where we say, well, now the Senate really is dysfunctional and something needs to be done?
Well, after the House just had a series of debates on pornography, I suppose we could say we measure dysfunctionality by saying we can't measure it, but we know it when we see it. I don't think any of us would call for the abolition of the Senate, and I don't think any of us would call for having two House of Representatives either. What happened at the turn of the century or shortly thereafter is that we got the first cloture rule because that dysfunction reached a point where it endangered the national security of the United States, where you had five willful individuals who were blocking the ability of the United States to conduct its foreign policy. We're calling for a change that's much more modest, or a set of changes much more modest than that, just to try and create a little bit of an adjustment in the process. I suspect, even if there's no consensus on filibuster reform, there would be a widespread national consensus that the government is dysfunctional.
Some people, Republicans in particular, argue that when you talk about a change in culture, that results largely from the breakdown, the 59 or 60 Democrats versus 41 or 40 Republicans, and so Democrats are looking to pick off that one Republican and get cloture. And so that kind of breeds polarization, and that if you had 51-49 again, that would quickly resolve a lot of those issues. Judd Gregg makes that argument. And I was wondering if you guys could respond to that, if you think that's plausible.
I think the grass is always greener on the other side, and I think we hear these arguments depending on the size of the majority. We look and we see arguments, well, things would be different if we had 57 or 58 when they're down to 51. I think more likely, I think we'll come away from this current Congress saying, sort of Greg's intuitiveness here, gee, the system actually seems to work. But I think it seemed to work in a way because they're at 59 or 60 senators, right? They're able to do health care reform. They did credit card reform. They'll probably do financial services reform and a host of others. They may not get to energy. But a number of things will have been completed. But I think we lose sight of the fact that it's working because there's so many Democratic senators and they're in close proximity. If after the election you're down to 52 Democratic senators, I don't think the scenario that Judd Gregg is proposing is going to happen. I think more likely to see many more issues and legislative initiatives caught with no resolution. Now, part of that has to do with the timing of where we are in Obama's presidency as well. It's not just the number of majority party senators. But my sense is that when we've had, say, 2001, 2002, very narrow majorities, right, we've seen even greater calls from the majority side for reform. So I'm not certain that things would be quite so different, even if a majority didn't have to pick off one or two votes to get cloture.
Let me just say one thing. You know, these senators and these Senate parties are not acting in isolation. There are large, well-organized constituencies that are demanding that they exploit their parliamentary rights in the interest of the cause. A change from 59 to 55 to 52 or whatever does not change that larger environment that characterizes modern American political life. They're going to be pushed to exploit their parliamentary rights under all of those circumstances. And we've had a ratcheting up of this kind of syndrome under varying party sizes over the course of the last decade, over the course of the last generation. And, I just don't think that we're likely to see an end to that. I think this is a long-term condition where we've seen a fundamental change in Senate, in the nature of representation we get in the Senate, the nature of the external constituencies. That's a long-term change in our politics, and in the size and complexity of the Senate agenda that makes delay and obstruction such a powerful tool. Those are long-term things that I think require that we take a serious look at the inherited rules.
I just like to follow up on that a bit as well. Greg seems to be implying that if Democrats had fewer members, they would, in fact, move toward the Republican position, thereby attracting more Republican support, producing more moderate policies in the rest. But I think the realities that Steve has suggested of the contemporary party system suggest that isn't the case at all. In fact, what's been fascinating to see is how Democrats have put together majorities in the House and supermajorities in the Senate only with their own party or one or two Republicans in the case of the stimulus. The larger party, in this case the Democrats, are much more heterogeneous, representing a greater diversity of districts and states. And the fact is the negotiations are occurring. They're just occurring within one party because the other party, the minority party, is much more ideologically unified and, in this case, further from the center, therefore taking itself out of the process. The powerful forces leading to that are not going to change if their numbers get a little bit higher. And so I don't think that is a very promising alternative.
Just to take that healthcare example for a minute, there are three ways to get to 60 votes in the contemporary Senate. One is you get 60 Democrats and no Republicans, or 59 Democrats and one Republican. A second way is you get 10 or 12 Republicans and maybe you lose a few Democrats along the way because of the compromises you make. A third is that you get half of each party by moving to the middle and losing both ends. The latter two were pretty much precluded by a very, an almost explicit minority party strategy. It's not only, as Tom said, that Bennett and others who supported the Wyden-Bennett plan were told, don't you dare push that, that's off the table now. I called publicly a couple of times for the majority leader to bring it up on the floor just to see if, just as we had with the another initiative of Judd Gregg and Kent Conrad, a bipartisan initiative to have a deficit reduction commission, and seven Republicans who co-sponsored it voted against it in the end, whether you would get any of the co-sponsors voting for it. But we also know that when we did have genuine bipartisan negotiations led by Max Baucus and Chuck Grassley, that the Republicans involved with that were told in no uncertain terms by their leadership, don't you dare reach a compromise or you will find yourselves deeply damaged along the way. So if you have a parliamentary party strategy adopted by the minority, that's going to be more effective if they've got 45, 46, or 47, not less effective.
And on that bright note, the Senate lives for another day. I want to thank all of you for sticking with us, and thank you for our panelists who've been here today. And thank also to the Wiedenbaum Center at Washington University for helping co-sponsor us today, and to my staff at Governmental Studies for putting together a great event. Thank you.